The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning. It is 10 a.m. on Saturday, and that means it is time for your weekly dose of Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and I'm excited to welcome you to today's show as we have an excellent guest with us live here in the studio. Steve, thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
So if you're not familiar with this program, Nature Nuggets was inspired by how fortunate we are here in the Hudson Valley and Catskills area to live in a place where we're surrounded by such rich natural beauty. We've got incredibly diverse ecosystems and vibrant biodiversity. And so this show is about taking an hour every week to take a break from the drumbeat of doom and gloom that is what's become of the daily news cycle, and to tell some stories about the natural world. And the way that we do that is that we seek out experts and nature lovers of all sorts, from academics and authors to conservationists and scientists. We bring them in the studio to help tell us some stories and share their insights about the natural world. And the idea being, hopefully, that each week our listeners can come away from the program with a little bit of a deeper understanding about what you might encounter if you step outside and look around. And so an important part of this show is the emphasis that nature is not something that's out there. You don't have to go to the top of a mountain or a remote forest to be immersed in nature. Right here, looking out the window of our studio in Midtown Kingston, we are very much in nature. And if we slow down just a little bit and pay attention to what's going on around us, inevitably, we will see fascinating ecological interactions between creatures of all kinds unfolding right in front of us. I saw that just on my little 10-minute walk here today. There were so many birds singing and fighting with each other, robins and house finches, and the chimney swifts were waking up and starting their chatter in the sky. So pollinators were kind of coming out after the rain to the remaining blooms here on Broadway Street. So the idea that I kind of built this show on is that people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So I'm going to start the program, as we do every week, with a segment called Who's About Town, which is a little bit like the society pages of a newspaper, except it's about the more than human world. It's where we take a little snapshot about what's happening this past week in the region since the last program. And I, of course, am a lifelong birder. And so the first thing on my mind is that, last time I was on the program, because I missed last week, Chris Baker filled in from Chicory Naturalist. But 2 weeks ago, I was saying that the trickle has begun because the first arrivals were coming. I had seen a brown thrasher and started to see some birds arrive. But now the spigot is open. The migration is in absolutely full swing. And so you certainly, if you are a birder, but even if you're not, this window, literally right now, this week, next week, and maybe the week after that, are the most exciting time to be looking for birds across the whole year. And so we've got the really fancy birds coming in now from the tropical rainforest. So these are the Baltimore orioles and the rose-breasted grosbeaks and the summer tanagers, the indigo buntings, and of course the warblers. I think we have something on the order of 26 species of warblers, each one of them just different, colored little jewels with different songs that can pass through our region during migration. So this is a moment to look up, go outside, dust off your binoculars if you have them, and you're gonna, you're, you know, and also you know, the birds are doing the most interesting behaviors of the year that they're ever going to do. They're singing their hearts out and fighting with each other to establish territories. They're building nests of all kinds. You know, you've got platform nesters and ground nesters and cup nesters and cavity nesters. And so they're pulling out, you know, fuzz from the bushes to line their nests, and they're breaking twigs off of, you know, branches. And so they're just up to a lot of very interesting things right now. And another interesting thing about this particular moment, you know, down here in Kingston itself, the leaves have largely leafed out. But if you head a little bit up into the Catskills, the trees really are still pretty bare. But the birds have arrived. And so there you have this very fleeting moment where all these colorful tropical birds have arrived, but the leaves aren't there to hide them. And so they're more easily visible than they are at any other point of the year. And so if you're interested, if you can get outside, gain a little elevation, you know, that is a really neat thing happening this week. And so I'm going to take a quick aside from the Hudson Valley region to share a little bit about where I was last week. And because I was down on the Gulf Coast, and I was around Houston, Texas. And so I took an excursion. I got to see a little preview of what's to come for us as far as the bird migration goes. Because there is a place that if you're a serious birder, you learn about at some point, and it's a pilgrimage place for hardcore birders. It's called High Island, Texas, and it's on the Gulf Coast, and it's just a tiny little, it's a salt dome, so it's just raised about 40 feet above the swamp, but that makes it the highest elevation place between like Alabama and Panama or something on the Gulf Coast, and so it's a patch of forest. And so what happens is all these birds, all the, you know, dozens and dozens, basically, you know, every songbird that could be found on the East Coast has to cross the Gulf of Mexico. And by the time they get to that little patch of forest, they are exhausted and they're hungry and they're tired. And so there's a phenomenon that can happen in late April, early May, called a fallout. And it's literally where the birds just fall out of the sky. And if you hit it right, it can be like snorkeling for birds, where there's just, they're so tired that some of them are sitting on the ground and they're just, it's full. And we hit it a little bit off because the wind was actually at their back. So it was really good for the birds, not as good for the birders. But we also did get to see rookeries full of roseate spoonbills and tons of kinds of herons and egrets. And a roseate spoonbill is just about as fancy as a bird can get. If you haven't seen one or a picture of one, they're sort of like a flamingo with an orange tail and a giant cartoonish sort of spoon-shaped bill. And seeing them, you know, on these big awkward nests right in front of us was amazing. So I've talked about before sometimes, you know, if you're one thing that you can do if you're interested in kind of tracking and seeing the migration that's invisible around us is there's an incredible site called birdcast.info, and they use amazing sophisticated radar to track the movement of birds and which fly at night. And they can tell us what species in what numbers, you know, are flying at what elevation. It's incredible. Something that just didn't exist even a few years ago. And so I was looking at that and recently, and that, well, first of all, the numbers are very impressive. You know, you can put in, go to the website, you can put in Ulster County, and there's some nights where it's hundreds of thousands of birds are passing overhead each night. But then the next night, it'll be 2,000 birds. And then the next night, 250,000 birds. And then the next night, 1,500. So there have been, night by night, these wild swings in the number of birds. And so I was looking at that, and I'm pretty sure that's a direct reflection of the storm systems that we've been having, because they fly at night partially to use the sky to guide them. And when it clouds up and it's weather, it's harder to fly and they can't see the stars. And so they'll land and they'll wait. And so I think that these kind of wild weather swings we've been having have been reflected in the pulses of the birds coming. And so I was looking into the weather pattern, which has been kind of intense. Looks like we're getting a little break from it today, and tomorrow is supposed to be beautiful. But there's actually a meteorologist have a term called an omega block, which is a distinctive upper weather air pattern that apparently is a sign of seasonal weather pattern change. And so it's a, they call it an omega block because that's the shape of the storm, like the Greek letter omega. And so it's something that happens where I try to explain this right, but so there's an overall warming happening during the season. But at the same time, you have this kind of winter-like storm systems. And because of the shape of the omega, they kind of get stuck in the warming pattern. And so because the storms are surrounded on all sides by warmer air, they don't move. And so they just drain themselves out and basically have to sit there for several days until they slowly fade away. So that's what we've been experiencing this past week. And after a beautiful day tomorrow, it looks like we may be back in for it for the foreseeable future, next week and into next weekend. So if you have the opportunity this afternoon tomorrow will be great times to get out. And with that said, I want to let everybody know that today is the City of Kingston's 11th annual Earth Fair, which is a great event, happens down in the Rondout at the T.R. Gallo Park. And so it's going to include live Clearwater Festival music. There's going to be food trucks, children's games, all kinds of activities. There's going to be a swap market that's free. They're going to have electric vehicle displays, all kinds of little green education booths and opportunities. There's going to be boat rides, all kinds of cool things happening. And it's supported by Clearwater, the Hudson River Maritime Museum, and with support also from Radio Kingston. And the Catskill Mountain Keeper. So that event is free, and it's today, and it starts just as we end this program at 11 a.m. and goes to 5 p.m. And again, that's right down just on the shores of the Rondout here in Kingston. So I encourage folks to check that out. There also are just a ton of other events coming up, and I'm not going to go through and list them all right now, but I do want to talk about this Tuesday on the 13th is the Public Birding Day at the Farm Hub, right outside Kingston, kind of over near Hurley. And it's a great opportunity. It's a free event, and it's the only day of the year, as far as I know, that the public is invited to come walk the amazing habitats and land of the Farm Hub, because otherwise it's an operating farm. And so it's a self-guided, I think, mile and a half loop, but they do have folks set up at booths along the way who can help interpret and share what you're seeing. But it's absolutely beautiful. They've restored some really rare native grassland habitat there. And so there's some species like meadowlarks and even bobolinks that have returned. You're not going to be able to see many other places around here. And interestingly, I went last year to the Public Birding Day at the Farm Hub, and I discovered a yellow-crowned night heron, which was one of the first records ever for Ulster County. It was a very exciting bird. And I just saw on the Hudson River Almanac, the weekly email from the Department of Environmental Conservation that they send out for free if you're interested, that two of these yellow-crowned night herons were just spotted this past week out at Tivoli Bays. And so, you know, I think, and there's been a couple handful of other sightings, they're starting to increase. And so I think what we're seeing with that bird is the, you know, in real time, the northern migration of you know, through climate change and shifting patterns that's reflected in species that are able to move are starting to. And that's a bird that, you know, this would have been an unheard of place to find them decades ago, even years ago, but slowly but surely they are making their way north. Let's see. I think that the last Who's About Town that I will share for now is from the Catskill Crew newsletter, great weekly newsletter that you can get in your inbox that talks about all kinds of cool events, natural and cultural and otherwise, that are happening that coming week in the region. But they put in a great little short section about the morel season. So Morel season is short and unpredictable, and as they characterize it, addictive. But it can be one of the most rewarding foraging traditions in the Catskills. So these are wild mushrooms that pop up for just a few weeks each spring. And they have hollow stems and kind of honeycomb caps, which once you have a trained eye, they are very distinct and able to be distinguished. And they can be, small and thumb-sized, or they can be 5 or 6 inches tall. And but the thing is that, despite decades of research, no one has cracked the code on how to farm morels yet. And so what that means is that the only way to get them is to catch them, when they're in the wild in this narrow season. And so everyone is a real kind of treasure to find. And so here in the Catskills, morels come up sometime between early April and mid-June, starting in the lower Hudson Valley and then moving north and then up in elevation as the soil warms. And so, the signs that you're getting close is when you start to see apple blossoms. And so that's supposed to be a key indicator. But it's just it's a wonderful thing. Morels are absolutely delicious with a little butter and some garlic. It's a unforgettable and very unique kind of thing. So if that's something that's fun to you, there's also going to be a bunch of, if you're not a forager on your own, there's a bunch of opportunities to join foragers. From Chicory Naturalist lists that there's going to be an event called Abundance Foraging on May 18th. So that's next Sunday. And that's going to be down outside of Rosendale from starting at 11 a.m. So if you hit up the Chicory Naturalist website, you can find out details about that. And one of the things I love about Chris Baker's style of foraging is that, she doesn't just try to find the rare, native things. She really helps to educate about the quote-unquote weeds and all the other. There's a lot of things that we can easily overlook but actually make for some really good foraging. And that can be real seasonal. Okay, I am going to just encourage folks to check out, go to John Burroughs Natural History Society website, go to Opus 40 website. Instead of listing all these events, I'm going to just let you know there are tons of opportunities to get out with knowledgeable people into the field. Take your kids or go on your own and learn about the season. It's really exhilarating to be outside right now when the earth is coming alive and everything is just, every day is different than the day before. And with that, before we dive into the show, I am going to take a break to hear a few words from our community.
What does community radio mean to you?
Opens the space for many voices and the many voices that we have here in Kingston. So for me, it's really a privilege and a gift to come to Radio Kingston and also give my different voices a space to share with the community.
Radio Kingston, many voices, one community.
Hi, I'm Katie Scott Childress, president of the Ulster County Library Association. If you're an Ulster County resident, you now have online access to 5 major daily newspapers for free. The Ulster County Library Association is providing the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times to read online. The newspaper subscriptions are supported by funds from the Ulster County Legislature. As librarians, we want to ensure that people have access to reputable news sources so that you don't hit a paywall when you're trying to learn about important events. You just need a library card, and library cards are free. You can get one at your local library or on their website. To find out more or access the papers, click Read at the Ulster County Library Association's website, uclib.org.
What actually is time?
The news is discouraging.
Right now, things aren't going too good.
The first order of business is to self-regulate.
We might be having problems there.
Take a breath. That does not mean tune out. That does not mean get apathetic.
What actually is time?
Bird Time, during the Heavy Light Show, weekdays at 3:30.
15 minutes of mindfulness in community with Micah, Teresa, and special guests.
We are about to lock in and focus.
Bird Time, during the Heavy Light Show with Ida, weekdays at 3:30, here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9.
The Broadway Bubble is hosting a Mother's Day tea party this afternoon. The event will be an afternoon of celebrating and honoring mothers. There will be tea, light snacks, and desserts. The event is free and open to the public, and all are welcome to attend. Mother's Day Tea Party, today, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Broadway Bubble, 718 Broadway in Kingston. For more information, find the Broadway Bubble on Facebook. Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland. And I can see the Broadway Bubble out the window here in our little fishbowl studio as we record live today. So I am excited to introduce our guest for today. Thank you so much, Stephen, once more for taking time on your Saturday morning to be with us here in the studio.
It's good to be here.
So Stephen Shimrich has been a professor of geology and earth sciences at SUNY Ulster County Community College since 1999, where he's also served as STEM department chair and associate dean of academic affairs. And Steve's research interests are in geology and the geologic history of the Hudson Valley region and its geoheritage, which is a word I am looking forward to exploring with you, as well as the influence of geology on the region's history, development, and culture. Steve is also the author of the book Geology of the Hudson Valley, A Billion Years of History, which I think was 2020 published. Steve, before we kind of dig into, pun not intended, sort of the deeper issues of geology, I'd love to hear a little bit about your story. I know you've been with SUNY Ulster for 25 years, but what's a little bit about your path to being inspired to pursue geology as a career?
Well, I'm local. I grew up in this area in High Falls. Excuse me. And not a very good student in high school. I ended up being a high school dropout for a number of reasons. And I went to SUNY Ulster, Ulster County Community College, starting at age 17, actually. And there I met a professor, Bob Mattson, who was teaching a geology course. And I took it because I was a little bit interested. And I fell in love with it. I love geology. I love the fact that we could do field trips and we could travel around and look at things. And it just resonated with me. I always liked science. And so from there, I went on to SUNY New Paltz and earned a bachelor's degree, and then up to SUNY Albany for a master's. And then I went to the University of Illinois for a few years, working toward a PhD. And then I ended up with a couple of jobs, one teaching at a college in Pennsylvania, Kutztown University, which was just a one-year position. And then I went to Grand Rapids, Michigan for another one-year position. And then I saw that the professor I had originally had for geology, Bob Mattson, was retiring from SUNY Ulster, and there was a job opening, and that was in 99. So I applied and received the job, and I've been here ever since.
Oh, I love that full circle local story.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if we could start with some really broad brushstrokes for folks, because I'm not going to assume that our listeners, you know, have much of a geologic, you know, context or understanding. And one of the things that I love about geology is that it really seems like it's a practice of storytelling, right? You know, I think that something like birds, which is my kind of expertise, you know, I can inspire people about birds, but ultimately they sing and they fly around and they're colorful and they do interesting things. And so they kind of, you know, they do the work for themselves. But with rocks, a lot of people could look at a rock and go, but with the storyteller to unfold the history that is, you know, laid bare on the rocks, then they become absolutely, you know, fascinating. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you could maybe start with just big broad brushstrokes about sort of the geologic zone that we're in, and what are some of the major factors that have led to us seeing the sort of landforms that we experience today around us?
Sure. I'd like to say that you can walk through the woods and you see trees. But if you walk through the woods with a forester, suddenly those trees are individuals, right? And they're in various stages of their lives, and they could tell you all about them. And same with birders. You go walking through the woods and you hear bird songs. You're like, oh, that's nice. But when you walk through with a birder, oh, there's a blue jay, there's a cardinal, there's a, you know, whatever. And the same is true of geologists. When most people are driving up 209 here in Kingston, they see these gray rocks on the side of the road. Oh, they're rocks, right? And but when you go with a geologist, suddenly they become individuals. They're limestones, they're shales. They're not just limestones either. They're all different types of limestones that form in different kinds of marine environments. And then they could tell you, well, let's pull over and look at them a little closer, and you start to see some of them are full of marine fossils. And there's a whole story that the geologist could tell you about those rocks. A lot of science is learning to see things in specific ways, to pay attention to the natural world, to not just drive by the rock at 60 miles an hour, but to pull over, walk up, wade through the poison ivy, pick ticks off your legs later. But to look at those rocks in detail and to pay attention to what's there. And that, like I said, would be true of any science. A botanist goes in the woods and they get on the ground and get their knees dirty and look at those plants in detail, right? And the birder gets up at 5 a.m. and goes out and looks for those birds. So it's a matter of training yourself to look at the world. And so in our area, I think we're very fortunate in that there, for geology, there's a whole range of things we can see covering over a billion years of Earth history here. Excuse me. It's the seasonal allergies, actually, that are making me hoarse with everything blooming. But the rocks here are very diverse. I'm talking about the wider Hudson Valley area from New York City north up to the Adirondacks is over a billion years of history, with rocks down in the Hudson Highlands having formed a little over a billion years ago in a massive mountain building event. And then younger marine rocks that were laid down when this area was covered under a warm subtropical sea. And subtropical because of plate tectonics, the idea that the Earth's outer part is split into these rigid plates that are moving over time, moving only about as fast as your hair grows or your fingernails grow. But you multiply that by hundreds of millions of years, you can move them anywhere around the Earth. And back half a billion years ago, for example, North America was significantly a little bit smaller, rotated by about 90 degrees. And we were in the southern hemisphere here, around 30 degrees of latitude, a subtropical kind of climate zone, very different environment. And with higher sea levels, this area was underwater. And how do we know that? We know that because there are these limestones that form in that kind of environment full of marine invertebrate fossils, right on the side of 209, for example. You can find pieces of coral and these shelled animals called brachiopods and other types of marine invertebrate fossils. And so there's a history of that. And repeated mountain building events have affected our area as well, because when you look at the rocks on the side of the road, they're not nice, flat, layered horizontal rocks, which is how they would have formed from sediments as flat-lying layers. But they're tilted and they're folded and they're broken and faulted. And a lot of people think, well, you only find faults in California where you have earthquakes and things. But there are massive faults here in the east. They formed a few hundred million years ago, so they're not active today. But they were causing earthquakes at that time when there was mountain building going on here. There were ancient volcanoes, volcanic islands just off the coast some 450 million years ago. How do we know that? Because we can go down by the Hudson River, for example, near the Poughkeepsie Bridge, and there are these very heavily deformed shale layers that have volcanic ash beds in them. And those volcanic ash beds are from massive eruptions of volcanic islands just offshore at the time. And then as you move forward, several repeated mountain building events, which have folded the rocks. These rocks were not folded at the surface. I was telling my students, pick up a rock. Can you fold it? No. If you could do anything, you might be able to break it, but you can't fold it. And that's because these rocks folded at depth down in the crust, several miles down at the time when there was mountain building going on. Where are the mountains? They've eroded away. And I have students, for example, in one of my classes do a calculation using a modern weathering rate from studies in places like the Andes Mountains. It's just a fraction of a millimeter per thousand years how fast rocks weather. But again, the power of time, when you multiply that by tens and hundreds of millions of years, you could erode away multiple mountain ranges in the time that we've been here. So those sediments form new generations of sedimentary rocks, and the erosion of a mountain range to the east of us called the Acadian Mountains resulted in all of the sediments that now today, for example, form the Catskills. And those layers of shales and sandstones and conglomerates, pebble-rich rock layers, those were all sediments that were once washing down from these almost Himalayan-sized mountains that had formed from plate tectonic mountain building and washing into a shallow sea off in what's now central New York. And this area was like modern-day Bangladesh, where the Ganges River and other rivers are draining the Himalaya and forming a massive delta out into the Indian Ocean today, the Bay of Bengal. We had these Acadian Mountains, they were called, to the east, which rose from mountain building, eroding, and the sediments washing to central New York there, forming what was called the Catskill Delta some 350 million years ago. And in that delta were the earliest forests that existed on Earth, for example. And you could find these plant fossils throughout the Catskills. And it was also a time in the evolution of life when fish were evolving into amphibians. And in other parts of the world, rocks of that age, we find some of the earliest transitional fish to amphibian fossils. And so very different worlds reflected here. And of course, more recently, the massive ice age that once completely covered all of New York with a mile thick sheet of glacial ice. And
wow. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Steve Shimrich, who is a geology professor and author of the book Geology of the Hudson Valley, A Billion Years of History. And Steve, thank you so much. It's just mesmerizing to hear you unfold the story of a billion years. And there's one of the core things about geology, I think, is that our understanding geologic time, or like our brains, you know, aren't necessarily designed to understand a million, 100 million, a billion years. And so the processes that you're talking about someplace like where we are now that has actually moved around the entire planet, and the rocks that we're looking at that have dived into the crust and come back and been pushed back up. And, you know, there's just there's a rich, dramatic story happening behind every rock that are beside you on the trail. It's so great to hear you talking about that. In your introduction, well, first of all, let me back up a little bit, and I want to ask just sort of a very, very sort of basic question, but one that I think might be of interest to some of our listeners. And this was something just struck me as such a novelty when I first moved to the region, and I really haven't gotten over it, which is, why does the Hudson River flow both ways?
It's tidally affected.
Yep.
And so it's just the orientation, I think, in the shape of the harbor down in New York there, sort of amplifies the tidal effect of the water. And so all the way up to Troy, actually, the dam at Troy, there's a tidal influence on the Hudson River where it will rise and fall each day. And so the river will reverse direction. So it's basically an estuary, which is a drowned river valley due to raising of sea level after the last ice age. During an ice age, when the peak of the last advance of glacial ice was about 18,000 years ago, sea levels were significantly lower because glaciers form when it snows and basically doesn't melt again. The water doesn't go back into the oceans. And so you're evaporating water off the oceans. It's falling as snow and accumulating over tens of thousands of years and forming these masses of glacial ice. Sea level drops significantly. So what today is the continental shelf, large parts of that were above water is the coastal plain. And there's actually a canyon, the Hudson Canyon, that extends out from the mouth of the Hudson on the continental shelf today. And then when sea level rose, the dry valley that the Hudson was flowing through became flooded. And so that tidal effect is still there.
Yeah, it's an amazing phenomenon to be 100 miles almost from the ocean and watch the river rise and fall each day. Would it be a proper to call something like the lower section of the Rondout here in Kingston a fjord?
The lower part of the Rondout?
Well, because it's tidal for a few miles up.
I mean, a fjord is a drowned glacial valley. So, I mean, this whole area is essentially a glacial valley in a sense. So people argue about that. I mean, there's a gradation. We try to put these man-made labels on things that are a continuum. And so I think I've heard people arguing that the Hudson Highlands should be considered a fjord because of the more dramatic nature of the Hudson there and the very deep depth that the Hudson had carved there, which the bottom of the river is not the bottom of the canyon that exists there in the Hudson Highlands. And the river actually does change considerably from New York northward because the rocks change. And down in Rockland County, there's a lot of sandstones and shales that are more easily eroded. So you have the very wide Tappan Zee there. And then you hit igneous and metamorphic rocks in the Hudson Highlands that are much older, much more hard and resistant rocks. And the Hudson becomes very narrow going through parts of the Hudson Highlands and makes some very funny kinds of turns, which is also why the Hudson there was very strategic because it was narrower. And there were these turns where some military fortifications like West Point was selected because of its location on the river. And the ancient faults through those very old rocks partially controlled the path of the Hudson as it eroded down through there. And then north of the Hudson Highlands, when you start to get to the area of Newburgh, the rocks again become shale and sedimentary rocks, and the river becomes wider again. And so, the river changes character as you go from north to south because of the changes in geology and the bedrock geology. But all of this was overprinted by the glacial ice age moving down and pushing and carving down as well. And the Hudson actually, before the ice age, it actually, by the Tappan Zee there, Piermont, there's a gap in the what's called the Palisade Sill, their area, called the Spark Hill Gap. The Hudson once flowed through that gap and then flowed inland and down into New Jersey and then out further south, Raritan Bay, down past Staten Island was the mouth of the Hudson before the Ice Age. So things changed quite a bit before and after glaciation. And so, most of the time the word fjord is reserved for more dramatic types of landscapes.
Well, I knew there was different camps on that. So, one of the things in your book that I really love is that you write all about geology, but you also really write about a lot of the intersections. And in your bio, you use the word geoheritage, which I hadn't come across before. And I just absolutely immediately love that word. And I believe, I think I get it, but I would love to hear you explore a little bit about, how the geology and the deep history of the region has shaped, everything from the you mentioned the Revolutionary War battles, but then up and through our, you know, economies and settlements, and talk a little bit about that term geoheritage and what it means in our specific region.
Right. And that's a term I wasn't really aware of until a few years ago. I'm a member of a professional society called the Geological Society of America, which has thousands of geologists as members. And they hold annual meetings and such. And geoheritage is a term that started to be used more and more for sessions of their conference for talks. And I actually was at a talk. I gave a talk last year in Anaheim, California, at our annual conference on some geoheritage in the Hudson Valley. And so geoheritage refers to geological sites or outcrops that have some other historical or aesthetic or economic importance in some way that it has. It's more than just a pretty rock that would excite a geologist, right? There's some history attached to it. And that's what I've always been interested in, is the connections between everything. And so, for example, the economic development of the Hudson Valley for the past few hundred years, from earliest times, you know, Henry Hudson sailed up in 1609, and since then, Europeans have been settling the Hudson Valley. And so early on, the discovery, for example, of iron ore down in the Hudson Highlands area, and the importance of the iron ore in the Revolutionary War efforts, and the discovery of clays along the Hudson River. And these clays were once deposited in what was called Glacial Lake Albany, which was, you know, when this area was covered by a mile thick sheet of glaciers, the glaciers eventually melted away. Well, that generates a lot of water. And for a time, that water was dammed up and formed this great freshwater lake in what's now the Hudson Valley. And on lake beds, you typically get very fine clays settling out on the lake bed. And those clays are just great for making bricks. And so the brick-making industry, and being on the Hudson River, those bricks could be shipped down to New York City to build all of those brick buildings down there. The rifting of the supercontinent of Pangaea formed what we call, geologists call, rift valleys, and one of them is called the Newark Rift. Another is a Connecticut Rift, which runs along the Connecticut River in Connecticut, Massachusetts. But the Newark Rift down in New Jersey extends up a little into southeastern New York and in Rockland County. But forming in that rift valley were these sediments that were washing down into the rift valley that were reddish because they were oxidized. There was iron in those sediments, and they're exposed to the air. They become basically rusty and red. And certain rocks formed in that kind of environment were the brownstones that were mined they're basically just sandstone to a geologist. But those buildings in much of New York City called the brownstones, those rocks formed during the rifting of Pangaea about 200 million years ago. The bluestone industry, of course, here in the Catskills was provided many of the curbstones and sidewalk stones for New York City as well. And then the natural cement industry locally as well, from Kingston south into Rosendale. It was called the Rosendale Cement District. And this was a type of limestone that you could crack up and burn in kilns and crush it into a powder, and you have cement. You just add water, and it goes hardens back into rock, basically. And so the natural cement industry, which started in the early 1800s, by the late 1800s, provided more than half of the cement for the United States. Tremendous industry. And New York City was literally built with geological materials from the Hudson Valley.
I love that. The picture you're painting of being able to walk through Brooklyn or any part of New York City, and really much other East Coast cities, and as well. But the ground that you're walking on, the homes that you're living in, the bridges that you're driving over, from the cement to the bricks to the stone, is literally the story of the geology of our region. And a lot of that flowed through Kingston, and down the river. And that's just such an eye-opening way of looking at, we are, the natural world shaping our human world, and the illusion of separation between those things. And I wanted to pull you since you brought up limestone, I just wanted to pull on a string a little bit there. One of the things that really fascinates me about geology is the kind of inextricable intertwinement between biology and geology. And that limestone encapsulates that maybe more than anything else I'm aware of. And I wondered if you could just give a quick telling about the history of, because limestone was literally once alive, right?
Yes.
So cement is a living creature. Wait, I'll leave it to you.
So limestone is a very common sedimentary rock. It forms from sediments, right? Small grains of mineral material. And limestone, the mineral that makes it up, is called calcite, or calcium carbonate, CaCO3. And you've seen a lot of calcite associated with living things, because if you've seen coral reefs, the hard part of the coral is calcite, basically. And shells of marine creatures, clam shells, oyster, mussels, all those shells are made of calcite. And there are a lot of other marine invertebrates that make hard parts basically out of calcite. That started a little over 500 million years ago. Prior to that, animal life, which the first multicellular animal life goes back to about 750 million years ago, was soft and squishy. They didn't have hard parts. But with changes over time in the atmospheric chemistry on Earth, the composition of our atmosphere, the oxygenation of our atmosphere, the oceans changed as well. And early in Earth's history, the oceans were more acidic, and you couldn't even form calcite in the oceans. It would dissolve. But as the atmospheric chemistry changed, the ocean chemistry changed, the oceans became more as to what they are today, which is more alkaline, and you could support calcite formation. And so these, what clams and coral polyps and things do, they can extract calcium and carbonate ions from seawater and create calcite as a hard protective structure for their bodies. When all these organisms die, this calcite eventually breaks down into what's called carbonate mud. And that carbonate mud, as it gets buried under long periods of time and compressed and lithified, turned into rock, literally, becomes limestone. And incorporated within that sometimes are still pieces of those organisms or imprints of those organisms as fossils. And so limestone itself is almost a fossil, right? A rock that is almost a fossil, right, of once living things. And so the natural cement, the Rosendale natural cement, is actually a little different than limestone. It's called dolostone. It's basically limestone with a little magnesium replacing the calcium, and it makes a harder rock. And this rock unit, one of the big ones that was mined for natural cement, was called the Rosendale dolostone. And that rock also has some clay minerals in it. It was close enough to shore that some weathering from rocks on land brought clays into the sediments. And those clay minerals added certain elements like iron and aluminum and things. And so this Rosendale dolostone rock unit just happens to have the ideal chemical makeup to make a natural cement. Today, they mine other limestones to make cement, but then they add what's missing. Mm-hmm. So they'll throw some shale and other things in there and mix it. It's a very scientific process today, where it's all analyzed and just the right ingredients are added. But there are some rocks that just had the right composition by chance to make a natural cement. And
well, I just love what that does to my brain. You know, when you're able to kind of take yourself there into that geologic time lens, then the boundaries between life and biology and rocks and you know, inert matter just dissolve. It's a helpful perspective, I think, even for our, you know, momentary fleeting lives.
Well, there's a whole field of geology called geobiology where some mineral formation, for example, is thought to be assisted by the biofilms, which are bacterial films, right? And they've discovered certain types of bacterial life that actually can live in solid rock, you know, and from seafloor cores of rock from the seafloor, finding certain types of microbial life that can exist in these weird extreme environments, and they don't need photosynthesis, right, for energy, or they don't need to eat organic material. They use chemosynthesis.
Right.
They get their energy from breaking down things like methane and hydrogen sulfide and things like that. And so it's a crazy world out there, really.
Well, it really is, and I think some of these things we could take for granted, but like the story you were saying about, you know, plate tectonics, and we've got to take a break to hear some words from the community in just a sec, but, you know, I remember learning about plate tectonics in college, and then, you know, there was a sub note about, oh, you know, this basically discovered in the, or, you know, accepted anyway in like the 70s. And, you know, I was born in the 70s. I'm like, wow, this is, you know, we take it for granted. But these are, you know, in the history of even humanity, kind of radically new concepts and discoveries that are being made all the time. And even closer when you're talking about these extremophile creatures. So, you know, what what's left to discover, considering, you know, the fundamental reshaping of our understanding that's happened just in past decades, remains very exciting. You know, it's not static. but with that, we are just going to take a quick break to hear some final words for the hour from the community.
Hi, I'm Phil from the City of Kingston Parks and Recreation Department. With the changing seasons, we're happy to say that Parks and Rec is offering even more programs and activities for our community. There's something for all ages, abilities, and interests. For the sports lover, we're offering programs like beach volleyball, basketball, and softball. If getting out and about is more your speed, we will be leading kayak paddles on the Hudson and community bike rides this spring and summer. And during the dog days of summer, when all you want is to take it easy, come out and join us for a movie in the park. We have free drop-in after-school programs at the Hodge and Rondout Community Centers for all school-aged children. And we have kids programs for spring and summer breaks, too. To register for programs, rent facilities, or get more information, visit us at kingston.recdesk.com. That's kingston.recdesk.com.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices, one community.
It's music.
Hi, I'm Annie Nero. Join me Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. for Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Each week, we'll come up with a musical theme. It could be anything at all, a theme loosely related to something going on here in Kingston. We'll stretch that theme so far that it's unrecognizable, but the theme will always be there.
It's music.
Like a jazz improvisation that goes so far out but returns to its standard melody. There's no genre of music, just a theme. Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Nature Nuggets, and I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland. And we've been having a great conversation with Stephen Shimrich, who's a professor of geology and the author of The Geology of the Hudson Valley, A Billion Years of History. And Steve has been taking us on quite a journey, kind of unpacking the story of hundreds of millions of years contained in, you know, the rocks of our region. And so, you know, with the minutes left that we have in the hour, and knowing that, you know, we're entering the season of warmth and getting outside, I was hoping, Steve, that you could share with us some of your favorite places around, you know, there's so much forest here and so much growth that a lot of times the rocks can be difficult to see, but I know there's some specific places where there's opportunities to really, you know, see some of these stories up close and personal.
Well, yeah, I live locally, so I always have a Mohonk Preserve pass and a state park pass, so I can go to Minnewaska. The Shungums are one of my favorite places to go hiking because you can go on a little more challenging trails as well as the nice gentle carriage roads. I do go hiking up in the Catskills. I especially love the area around North Lake. Mm-hmm. At times down by the Hudson Highlands as well. I do teach a 2-week summer field course on the geology of the Hudson Valley. That's what my book actually came out of, because there really wasn't a textbook that you could use for a course like that. Just lots and lots of papers and articles and things from all different sources. But when I go out with students, we have to go to a number of different places because each place just tells one part of the story. The Shungum Ridge has this white quartz pebble conglomerate that formed from streams draining off what we call the ancient Taconic Mountains. And the Catskills, they're 100 million years younger, but also represent sediments coming off of an ancient mountain range. And then the Hudson Highlands area, Harriman State Park, Bear Mountain, that area represents rocks, igneous and metamorphic rocks that formed over a billion years ago, 12 miles below the surface of the earth under very high pressures and temperatures. And so up by Thatcher Park, west of Albany, a beautiful Indian Ladder Trail there, which was a classic site for early geologists in New York State to study rocks that formed in what was called the Helderberg Sea, which once covered this area that formed a lot of the sedimentary rocks that you see in the valley here. And so different places record different parts of the history. And I think we're very lucky in living in this area that there are so many parks and areas that you can go to that are really quite beautiful and not only geologically showing rocks, but also biologically and with the entire natural world.
Absolutely. So I just want to say again, you're listening to Nature Nuggets. This is Stephen Shimrich. And if you've just caught part of this conversation and you're interested in catching the rest of it, this show, like all of our episodes, will be archived at RadioKingston.org. Just go on there and look under Nature Nuggets. We also have a Instagram presence, if you're on Instagram. Our handle is at @HVNatureNuggets. And you can also contact the show directly if you want to email us and suggest a guest or ask a nature question that we can see if we can answer. That's naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. And before we wrap, I want to say one more time that right now, starting in 5 minutes, is the 11th annual Earth Fair put on by the City of Kingston. It's down at TR Gallo Park right here in the Rondout, and there's going to be live music from Clearwater Festival. There's going to be food trucks and games and activities for kids, electrical vehicle displays, boat trips, all kinds of cool things going on down there. It's a free event, and it's going to start at 11 a.m. and go till 5 p.m. And it looks like we're going to get a little merciful break in the weather for that. So, I guess, Stephen, we just got, a couple more minutes. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing your, incredible knowledge with us. And I guess, since we have such a limited time, I would say, any encouraging words. I know that you're also a hiker and a, outdoor adventurer yourself. And if, if someone was looking for something to do on the sunny day tomorrow, where might you send them?
Well, I guess it depends where they are, but I would probably send them to the Shungums for a walk. Unfortunately, on the weekends, it can be very crowded there. I tend to avoid those hikes on the weekends and try to get out on weekdays where it's a little quieter, but I tend to be more antisocial when I'm out in the woods, and enjoy the peace and quiet and the bird song. But there's such beautiful areas here. I would probably not go in the Catskills right now just because the trails are probably very, very muddy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I do have a friend who's going to be doing a whitewater rafting trip down the Esopus tomorrow because it's with the water levels and the kind of post-flood stage, I guess it's perfect for doing that. So that's an exciting outdoor adventure. All right, well, I'm hearing the musical cue, so we've got a wrap, but thanks once again for coming in person on Saturday morning, Steve. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
Enjoyed it. No, thanks.
Myself to you completely.